Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. What's that? Yeah, well. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everyone. It's a beautiful green day in Minnesota. Some of us forgot to wear green, but you'll have to forgive
Swedes
me. I'm mostly Swedish by heritage, so I don't remember all these things. Anyway, welcome to committee. We do not have a quorum at this point in time, so we will not take any official action until we do have a quorum. In the meantime, we will get started with our presentations. We're starting out today with Ramsey County. Please introduce yourself for the record. Or did you want to start out, Representative Lilly?
Mr. Chair, however you want to do it.
You look anxious, like you really want to get in there. So.
Well, I'm just doing one piece of. With me, I have a couple of Ramsey County commissioners, and maybe they want to introduce themselves, and then we'll get into the individual projects.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Jim McDonough, Ramsey County Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Ramsey County Commissioner Mary Jo McGuire, and proud former House member and Senate member. Happy to be here, and thank you for hearing our legislative.
Thank you very much. Welcome to committee. We actually have a quorum, so we're going to get our minutes approved right now, so we don't forget to do that. Representative Vogel, have you read the minutes, and do you move approval? Vogel moves approval of the minutes of March 15th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And opposed by the same sign. Minutes are approved. Please go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're gonna start with the Battle Creek Winter Recreation Project, and it's a $2.1 million request, and it's matched 50-50 by other money, so that's kind of exciting. But it's basically snowmaking equipment. As you all know, in the last couple of years, snow has been very unpredictable in Minnesota, and what we're trying to do is create a world-class venue in the East Metro. There's one over in the Minneapolis area over Theo Worth, and we're trying to create a similar opportunity here in the East for high school athletes and bringing in events from the state, so there's a big tourism component. But with me, I have some folks that are real people that are out there driving the effort and coming up with matching money, some of the skiers, and then Commissioner McDonough is going to kind of talk about it, and like to pass it to him, sir. But thank you very much for hearing the bill. It's kind of hard to talk about some of these projects, and it may seem like it's not important, but it really is. We're kind of in the high school hockey or basketball and high school sports season, but I mean, there's some very serious athletes, both men and women, that are have this cross-country and winter sports activities that they can participate in. And quite honestly, women are probably even, as Americans, are probably even more successful than the men and really have led our country in the winter sports, as we know with our great, Lindsey Vonn and others. But anyways, I'll pass to Commissioner Donna, and go ahead, sir. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and committee members. First off, I want to wish everybody a happy St. Pat's Day. As a good Irishman, I couldn't not start off, and also I would like to share with you a blessing that I passed on to my daughter and her husband at their wedding is, may all the slivers be facing the right way as you slide down the life of the banister of life. All right, we got that out of there.
Uh-huh.
All right, so I don't want it to go unnoticed. I am missing walking with the McDonoughs downtown St. Paul right now. That's how important this project is to me. And I'm glad to be here with you today, and I appreciate hearing this. This is a project that Ramsey County has been working on for a number of years. But this year, we've really got the wind in our sails on this project. The support from the community has just been tremendous, and you're going to hear from some of those community members. The support on the Ramsey County Board is solidly behind this in committing $1 million as a part of the match and working with the groups here to continue to make sure that we have ongoing operation funds to keep this a top-notch, world-class facility here in East Metro. As a representative, Leon Lilly, pointed out, You know, there are a couple of facilities in the state. The East West Metro, of course, has one, but the demand is so high. I live right across from Fayland Golf Course, which does cross-country ski, and they groom. And there are some winters where they're using that maybe one, two, three times a winter, a day, you know, a couple of days a winter. And so the need here is high. You're going to hear from the coaches. You're going to hear from the volunteers that organize youth to expose them to this sport. My job here is to communicate to you the importance of this from the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners and our commitment to fund and do the match of $1 million and working on the operations of this. So I'll turn it over to John Oganagi, who's our Parks and Rec Director, and John can give you the specifics and the details of the project. Thank you.
Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Oyanagi, and today it's O apostrophe capital Y. I'm the Director of Parks and Recreation for Ramsey County. And as has been said, I want to describe the project. I want to thank you first. Many of you made it out to tour the site on your fall bonding tour, and we enjoyed having you out there to see the actual facility. As you could tell on that day, a substantial amount of work has been done on this area. It's already a winter ski destination, but this project makes it a total winter recreation wonderland. So it'll have the cross-country ski component, but also a downhill ski area for people learning how to downhill ski, as well as tubing, which is a tremendously popular winter activity, and then also snowboarding. So that's also been growing in popularity as well. The City of St. Paul operates the Battle Creek Recreation Center at this site and operates outdoor skating rinks as well. So it truly has multiple winter recreation activities for people to come and participate in. The snowmaking is the key component, as has been said. Our winters have been non-existent as far as snowfall, and this would help create an extended season both at the beginning, middle in some cases, and also at the end of the season. It'll create an economic impact. The project itself will create 30 to 50 jobs during the project for designing, engineering, and construction, and also will create permanent jobs to operate the facility and seasonal jobs to operate the facility as well. Probably about half the cost is associated with the labor involved in the project, so it's very much a driver for jobs. The other people will talk about what it means to them as community members and stakeholders in this project, so I'd like to turn it over to Andrew Poffenberger, who will talk more about what that means to the skiing community.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Andrew Poffenberger. I'm the executive director of a St. Paul-based nonprofit named Endurance United. Battle Creek has served as our home and is perfectly suited to help us deliver our mission to promote an active, healthy, and outdoor lifestyle through cross-country ski coaching and by hosting endurance events and races. Through years of cooperation and financial investment by both the county and outdoor community, Battle Creek has been improved significantly. The development and maintenance of a world-class network of trails, in addition to the installation of trail lights, provides an ideal location for beginners and Olympians alike. Endurance United works with a wide spectrum of participants, from elementary school kids to 70-year-olds who are still chasing the dream. Areas like Battle Creek help to promote lifelong involvement in healthy activities. All that is missing is consistent snow. Not all that long ago, there were only two indoor hockey rinks in the state. Minnesota is now known as the state of hockey. Minnesota invested in hockey rinks across the state because we saw the value in preserving that tradition. Minnesota has three man-made ski loops currently. We're home to the most cross-country skiers in the country, and I'd like you to join Ramsey County and the outdoor community by investing in Battle Creek so that we can ensure that Minnesota remains the state of skiing. Thank you. Next up, John Baker, who's one of our board members at Endurance United.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Baker. I'm a local attorney. I'm the vice president of Endurance United. And one of our goals of the organization is, as the St. Paul version of this organization, is we would like to get communities of color out on the cross-country ski trails. And we have a goal of having the first Olympic cross-country ski team member coming from the St. Paul area, coming from Minnesota. And I think we can do that. Making snow in the Battle Creek will help us a long ways to do that. So thank you.
Please introduce yourself for the
record. Hello, my name is Chrissy Snyder, and I am the leader of the Battle Creek Club for the Minnesota Youth Ski League. MYSL is a club-based organization that offers youth aged 4 through 14 and their families the opportunity to learn, develop skills, and enjoy cross-country skiing together. MYSL has 27 clubs across the state. Battle Creek has 143 skiers. This was the first year, however, that MYSL enrollment did not grow because of caps at all of our locations with snowmaking loops and low interest in our other clubs. MYSL is very accessible. The skiers receive 8 lessons for $45, and they can rent equipment for $35 and keep it the entire season. I like to think that all the city kids out there, both the ones skiing and the ones sledding, are getting not only their exercise and fun at Battle Creek, but also a brief chance to be in the woods without having to drive far outside the city. Because of our location, we attract families from many different socioeconomic status levels and cultural backgrounds. In the past 2 years, we have had families whose primary languages are Spanish, Chinese, Russian, French, German, and English. Many of our families are new to skiing. These new to skiing families have come to believe that getting out into nature, getting kids away from computers, and enjoying cross-country skiing is a great way to stay healthy mentally and physically during our Minnesota winters. In the past 2 years, we have had to move. We have only been at Battle Creek for 5 of our 16 meetings. We have been forced to move to a snowmaking loop, meaning families either drive approximately 30 minutes further away or they do not go skiing. Most of the families do not make this drive, and their kids do not enjoy the health benefits of cross-country skiing. Often it is the kids who need this opportunity to be outside and exercising in nature the most who do not show up to our new locations. Battle Creek is already a Twin Cities treasure. Snowmaking at Battle Creek would improve the health and well-being of many families in the East Metro. Thank you. And next up is Ann Ricken from Minnehaha Academy.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ann Ricken. I've been the head Nordic ski coach at Minnehaha Academy for 17 years. And I choose to coach Nordic skiing because I feel it's important to help our students learn the value of hard work, the responsibility of being on a team, and learn a lifelong sport and a reason to love Minnesota winters. The tough years are the ones that don't get natural snow, and the last 2 years have been the hardest. You'd think with the 3 man-made trail systems in the city that would make it easier, but that's not really the case. These trails are all on the west side of town. The venues are the best trails, but they are very scheduled, difficult to get team trail time, and quite expensive. I know that Woodbury Ski Team paid for their trail passes, but never got an opportunity to ski in December. The MYSL that Chrissy just spoke of is an excellent feeder program for our high school teams, but if a student has not learned early, it is so hard to teach a kid to cross-country ski if they're not on skis. The students we coach get frustrated, lose interest, because all they're doing is running and dry land training when they join the Nordic ski team to ski. After each bad season, our teams shrink significantly. Other teams in my section, which is based, which is assigned by geographic location, they all struggle with the same problems. Several teams simply cannot afford the bus transportation needed to travel that far. Kids have to drive. We all know that that's not safe, especially during rush hour, in the winter, in the dark. It's becoming harder to do, but I believe with the addition of an East Metro guaranteed snow venue, it will be easier and more students will learn to love this outdoor sport. I'd like to introduce Avo Taipala, owner of Finn Sisu Ski Shop.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Avo Taipala. I've been in the ski business for 40 years in St. Paul and Lauderdale. Nordic skiing and ski market, United States is the fourth largest marketplace in the world. Midwest and Minnesota are the most important parts in the United States. And when we're looking at the events in the international scene and in the local scene, so many events have to be operated on the man-made snow and events like Davos World Cups and so on. We are looking at the Battle Creek Park as the international center can host many international events besides all the youth and adults here and locally. We expect 20,000 visits by the general public there, and high schools, 20 high schools alone, would get 18,000 visits there during the season. No other facility can accommodate that kind of numbers, like youth, high school, and adults. So I appreciate your attention, and thank you for the considering this project. It is going to be an international destination and big plus for the East Metro and St. Paul. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lilly, did you want to close this out?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And I'm sorry we've captured quite a bit of your time, but there's an amazing amount of enthusiasm and in this in the East Metro in the state. And it's so many different areas, all the way out to Stillwater and beyond, and close in as well. But these people are quite passionate, and it's a very nice. I think it'd be a great asset to the state, and the 50-50 that their match that they're able to accomplish is pretty impressive, actually. So, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. I don't see any member questions at this time, so let's move right along to the next presentation.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Representative Lilly, for your proud sponsorship of this bill and for all of your support and your tours. And we just really appreciate your dedication to healthy living, which we really support in Ramsey County. I now want to introduce my colleague, County Commissioner Blake Huffman, who's going to introduce the 694 and Rice Street project.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chairman and Representatives. Blake Huffman, County Commissioner from Ramsey County. I'll just start.
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm John Keyes, Mayor of Little Canada.
Thank you.
I'm Jim Polis. I'm the Director of Public Works for Ramsey. We're trying to get the graphic.
Yeah, okay. Do you need the technology working to move ahead?
Yeah, let me start while that's getting going. Okay. Let me get started. First of all, thank you for your time, Representatives, today. As you recall, the I-694 Rice Street Bridge request has been before you several times. And what it is right now, the urgency of this request now is even more urgent than before, in the sense of MnDOT has started the construction of a lane, of a third freeway lane below this bridge, both east and westbound. It's a critical junction. At Ramsey County, our number one goal, our overriding goal, is focusing on economic development. How do we take more of our residents and neighboring residents and make them more prosperous, or give them the structure to become more prosperous? Economic development is critical. This bridge right now is holding up economic development. We have a potential for 400 new jobs in the adjacent property that, once this bridge is complete, would happen. And even more importantly, we are now partnering with neighboring cities, Shoreview, Mayor Martin, Little Canada, who we'll hear from the mayor in just a moment, and Vadnais Heights, are all three cities that have all contributed money to help with this project.
Mr. Isaacson.
Yep. Mr. Chairman and committee members, I'm John Keyes, Mayor of Little Canada. And as you've stated already, since 2004, we've had the Min Pass Highway 36 done, all of the stuff, the Unweave the Weave, and we bore the brunt of that in terms of traffic and people coming through our city. But the one thing that Oh, by the way, thank you for Highway 36, St. Jude, and the business on the south end of Rice. Really appreciate it, because we've seen an uptick there. So while we appreciate this, we still haven't had the bridge done, the Rice Street 694 bridge, that was supposed to go before all of these other projects. It just was never done. And again, you've heard, you know, how bad it is, no turns. There's not a right angle at that thing. And one of the things that we're concerned about, the mayor's, is, again, development. We have an industrial park that's right down below Rice Street, and we've had complaints from the trucking businesses down there, that it's very difficult to get in and out of those places. It just, the flow is just terrible coming off that freeway and going down there. The other thing is, Rice Street is kind of Little Canada's main street, where we want to funnel all the traffic down to where our businesses are. So 36 did that for the south side. We need the north side taken care of with this bridge. And again, as stated, we've missed development opportunities because of this. You know, people look at that and they go, not quite sure if I want to get into this here. So, so not to take up a lot of time, we need your help to do this, because it really is a hardship for our development, for both Little Canada, Vadnais, Shoreview. And again, as I stated, we're so serious about this that we put money up front to move this along, so you get better feel estimates of what this will cost.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, please identify yourself for the record.
Jim Tullis. I'm the Director of Public Works for Ramsey County. We're trying to get the graphics going, but you all do have a handout.
We do.
That we can begin with. Let me go first.
Yeah,
as indicated, this project has been identified for many, many years. It was originally identified in terms of need in 2002, when MnDOT was negotiating for the turnback of Highway 49 to Ramsey County. And there was a commitment made at that time. We're still on. Are we coming up?
Excuse me while there's a break here. What is Highway 49 today?
Highway 49 is Rice Street.
It is
Rice
Street.
And it's part of the county state aid system, as it was turned back. And so the importance was recognized way back then and a commitment made. Go to the second slide. And in 2004, MnDOT, working in collaboration with our three partner communities, Shoreview, Little Canada, and Vadnais Heights, developed a concept that's before you here, and you've seen this graphic several times. It's a parklo design, and it's really a partial cloverleaf, and it adds a lot of operational benefit over a traditional diamond. The problem, it's a high-capacity interchange, and it works very well. The problem is, it has a very large footprint. It has a relatively high cost, and it is not friendly to access to properties proximate to the interchange area itself. It's also an unfriendly environment for pedestrians and bike access, which is becoming such an important element in our system these days. Can we flip to the next one? This project is particularly important, as Mayor Keats has pointed out. It is a major access point for our adjacent communities. It's also the major bottleneck as you come out of the unweave, both for 694 and 35E going westbound. This is the major truck bypass route around the Twin Cities to stay on I-94. And the incredible bottleneck occurs right at Rice Street, and that's the head end of a major employment corridor for the likes of Boston Scientific, Land O'Lakes, Smith Medical, Cummins Diesel. These are all major employers and collectively employ in excess of 20,000 individuals. And these are good jobs.
One thing, Representative Isaacson, one thing I want you to look at, when you look at the nearby employers, we've all heard of Land O'Lakes and Boston Scientific, but you may not know that Par Systems is one of the people that created the crane that's helping clean up the Fukushima, literally creating the crane that's going to go over there and clean up the Fukushima mess. And you go a little farther down, Adobe Software is right in that area, and we all are familiar with Adobe. It's a really big corporation, along with one of the main headquarters for Deluxe Checks, and the Deluxe Corporation that does a lot of banking. And so there's just a significant amount of businesses in this area and a really high concentration of jobs. And that's part of the reason why this is becoming more and more urgent every day in terms of our ability to have economic development in the Northeast Metro. Go ahead.
Look to the next slide. What we've done this year, and it's different than previous requests, in the last few years we've been requesting just sufficient funding to update the environmental documentation and perform engineering to deliver the project. This year, because of timing of MnDOT's lane add on 694, we think it's very important to move this project forward now. We have worked collaboratively with our communities, Ramsey County in cooperation with Little Canada, Vadnais, and Shoreview, are funding a preliminary concept development phase along with a market analysis to look at the development potential proximate to the interchange itself and also come up with a smaller, smarter design, one that is friendly to bikes and pets, one that can actually provide good access to the proximate property in that interchange area. And so the current interchange study looks at not only the transportation elements but also at development to provide support and enhancement for further development and redevelopment of the site. Right now, or just recently, Shoreview approved a land use development on the northwest quadrant of that area right now. It's a residential mixed use and it provides some senior living opportunities that are different than typical, or at least for that area. That same developer is very interested in actually doing the similar thing on the east side of that north terminal area. We also have the former public works site on the southwest quadrant that's in excess of 12 acres. It's a highly developable, highly visible site, and preliminary market analysis of that shows a technical industrial mix which could employ upwards of 400 people on that one site alone. And so we've looked at a design that can actually support access to all of these properties, and the total asset we're here with is a $20.5 million request. Now, that's for project delivery, project construction, and acquisition of any of the right-of-way that we would potentially need as part of the project.
Mr. Tolas, if I could interrupt for just a moment, do you have any idea what the breakdown would be between trunk highway funds needed and local road or bridge funds needed?
That hasn't been approached yet.
Okay, but when you get that information, please forward it to us. Thank you.
We flip to the next slide. This is an example. We actually started with seven major design alternatives. We're more innovative and creative than we were back in 2004.
And looking at this, you want to actually turn it one click like that, so it'll get me right on your map.
Right.
Turn it like this. So
the right side of your map is north. The left side is south. Yeah. This is an example of being more creative. Although the ramp configuration is very similar to a traditional diamond, in terms of the ramps coming off the interstate and going back on, we've coupled it with roundabouts at the terminal locations, and that opens the door to provide direct access to those adjacent properties. It also allows the bridge structure to be much smaller and a lower cost. It is also friendlier to bikes and pets. You want to flip to the next one? And another example of slightly different, but this actually, yeah, this is mimicking some of the changes on Highway 36 and Rice Street, where it's an offset single point diamond. It takes all of the ramps into a north terminal location and actually allows even better types of access on the south side of the interchange area. Again, much friendlier, a much smaller structure across the interstate, albeit we've got two ramp bridges. And providing very, very good access always around, and provides the better clearance on 694 for that particular thing. One more slide. We are right now in the process of completing our concept and market analysis. That is occurring right now. We hope to have an alternative selected or preferred alternative in mid-April. We're going to complete the design by mid-October this fall. In between, we've got 694 with MnDOT directing a lane addition. That'll be completed in the summer of 17. We'd be ready to go in November of 17 to bid that project for completion in 2018. And so with that, I will stand for questions.
Thank you. Just briefly, there's a railroad corridor near here, isn't there? Can you identify that on one of these maps for
me? That is westerly of what we're looking at here, and it doesn't go quite far enough west, but it is westerly.
And south.
And yes. Oh, there's one on south, too, but I think you're talking about the main one on the west side, the one that crosses 694 immediately to the west.
I don't know what I'm talking about. Okay.
There's so if you look at this map right here,
yes.
We can go to
back. I've been through that area a number of times, and it seems like line. I have to cross a railroad track to get where I want to go.
When you look at this, it's put it right size. This pink right here on the purple on the side, that is where the railroad is.
All right,
and it crosses down below on North Owosso, and then it crosses on as its own bridge by itself, separate from the interstate, about, I don't know, half a mile to the west.
Where it crosses over the interstate.
Yeah.
I see. Very good. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. We have a question from Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. So when I look at these diamond interchanges, the question that I have, you have roundabout, or it looks like there are roundabouts on the entrance and exit ramps, and there's no signaling on those. And my question is, where else has this been used as a continuous flow roundabout for an entrance and exit with similar type of traffic patterns in the state of Minnesota or even anywhere else in the country?
I don't know who wants to take that.
Representative, Ramsey County has not built any of these facilities, and I'm not aware of any in Ramsey County. I believe down at Cottage Grove, MnDOT has actually put one in, and the ramps do come into a roundabout configuration.
You don't happen to know what intersection that's at?
Oh, I don't offhand. That's not in my county.
It's off of 61.
Pardon?
It's off of 61.
It is as you go down 61.
Representative Dean has a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you do us a favor and get the comparison of the traffic counts on that particular built interchange and what they would be on this interchange as well?
We can certainly share that with you.
Thank you.
I can say that the traffic modeling that has been done to date shows a very high performance in terms of service levels with this configuration and the modeled traffic growth that we anticipate. So,
very good. Thank you for your presentation, and we'll move along.
All right.
And thank you, Representative Isaacson, for carrying that legislation. We have one final project we just want to spend a couple minutes on. It's the Landmark Center. It's the and our author, Representative Mariani.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members, Representative Carlos Mariani, District 65B, here in St. Paul. And thank you for this hearing. I want to introduce our testifiers here today, our former colleague in the House. I told her we still miss her, Mary Jo McGuire, who's our elected Ramsey County Commissioner, and Amy Mino, who's the Executive Director of the Landmark Center. And they're going to walk you through this request in terms of pre-design and pre-engineering for the Landmark Center. Let me just quickly say I have a history with this particular historic building, having served on its board way back in the early 1990s, and one of the architects of saving this building from the wrecking ball many, many years ago was my professor of geography in McAllister College, Dr. David Lannegren. Had a very forward-looking vision about the importance of this majestic building, and it really is very difficult to think about St. Paul without thinking about this iconic figure. It's one that serves a very practical purpose for many of the civic activities in the capital city, but frankly it also serves as a iconic draw for tourism into Minnesota, matching up with, you know, our historic St. Paul Hotel nearby, and of course the different arts amenities that are located there, including the Ordway Center, immediately south of the building. So it's an important, it serves an important function in our city, and it's a very old building, and these folks have some very exciting ideas about re-engineering and renovating this building, and so I'm going to turn over to them, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mariani has given you a great recap of the project. It is a pre-design, pre-engineering for a greater project that we anticipate for this project. And for those of you that may not be familiar, it is the castle-like building that's down in our Rice Park. It's got Ordway on one side, St. Paul Hotel on the other, the library across the way from there, and it is a beautiful building. It is on the National Historic Register, and I can't imagine our area, St. Paul, without it. So it does serve over 230,000 people each year. Most of the activities are free to the public because it is a public space, public building, and using public tax dollars. So we would appreciate any help that you can give us in really using this building to its maximum. There are spaces there that are not able to be used right now because they need further development, and so we are looking for pre-design dollars to help us with the starting to envision that, and that will actually, you know, make it even more available to members of the public and to entities that actually rent out of there. And now the executive director, Amy Mino, is going to just give us a couple of specifics.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Yeah. Use this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Amy Mino. I'm the executive director of the Landmark Center. And this project, it follows up on a phase two. Our first phase was an exterior restoration of Landmark Center. It just got completed. We're still finishing up a couple elements this summer, but it was a complete retuckpointing of Landmark Center and a replacement of the 100-year-old tower roofs. So the beautiful clay tile roofs, they have been completely restored for the next 100 years. So that project was a $3.9 million exterior renovation, and it was funded mainly by Ramsey County, $3.5 million, and then private, other public and private funding, too. This proposed project is phase two. It's interior, and there is you did receive a handout in your materials, which has some photos of Landmark Center, but also on the second page, some of the undeveloped areas that we want to get into and develop. So Landmark Center was renovated in the 1970s, and the beautiful courtrooms that are in the building, the beautiful atrium space, those are all being used, of course, today for all the festivals. In fact, today, the St. Patrick's Day Irish celebration is going on, and it's all green and a little bit of orange in the building today. Lots of wonderful dancing and music. These areas that we're looking at, though, are areas that were never developed in the 1970s, and they hold a huge potential for the building, but also for our area as a cultural district for in downtown St. Paul, really an anchor, the Rice Park area. And getting into them and bringing them into revenue-producing areas of the building would help enhance the entire area. So there are some great possibilities. This would be this proposal is the first step in determining how those spaces could best be built out.
Thank you. I don't see any member questions at the point in time. Anybody want to wrap up here quickly?
Yes, I will wrap up, Mr. Chair. Just want to thank you and all of the committee members for your time and attention to our projects. We think that our projects actually envelop the mission of Ramsey County, which is about healthy living for mind, body, and soul, and also about economic development with our roads projects and bridges projects, and then our arts and cultural heritage with our landmarks. So we would really appreciate all of your support and appreciate all the work that you're doing.
Thank you,
and thank you to all of our authors, Representative Lilly, Representative Isaacson, and Representative Mariani. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Mariani, for being here. Thank you for your presentation. And we'll move on to Hennepin. Thank you.
Yes.
We'll move on to Hennepin County.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Point of order.
Yes, Ms. Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, it's come to my attention, and actually we have at the testifier's table a county commissioner from Scott County, but we also have another former Scott County commissioner at the table who is a legislator, and I might just add that he is celebrating, for those in the audience and around the table, a somewhat momentous occasion in his life today. So on behalf of the Scott County delegation, I'd like to extend and wish my sincerest wishes to Representative Vogel on the occasion of his birthday today.
Hear, hear. Hear, hear. Representative Vogel, would you like to make a rebuttal?
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank everybody for allowing me to now be on Social Security.
Thank you. I just wish it wasn't taxed. Thank you. Please go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and please go ahead with your presentation.
My name is Andrew Baker.
And I'm Barbara Marshall. I'm the chair of the Scott County Board of Commissioners.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I'm the chief medical examiner for Hennepin, Dakota, and Scott Counties. I've been a practicing forensic pathologist in Minnesota for 14 years and a chief medical examiner since 2004. I'm also a proud alumnus of the training program in forensic pathology at the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office, having trained under the previous chief in 1997. I'm only the third chief medical examiner in the 53-year history of the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office, and I'm unaware of any major municipality or state in America that has such a track record of long-term stability. That legacy alone speaks volumes about the importance my elected leaders have placed on quality death investigation in Minnesota. In January of 2013, the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office entered into a partnership with Dakota and Scott Counties for full-service death investigation and autopsies performed to or exceeding national standards. With the nationwide shortage of qualified medical examiners, the increasingly stringent standards of forensic science, and the need for modern facilities to house the work we do, the former medical examiner's office in the basement of the hospital in Hastings was not a viable long-term model for Dakota County or its then partners. Building its own morgue or even assuming the practitioners to staff it could have been found would have been cost prohibitive for a single county. It only made sense for counties like ours to partner to provide this mission-critical component of government. I am proud to note that this long-term Dakota, Scott, and Hennepin area partnership is well into its fourth year of operation, and my regional medical examiner's office now provides death investigation and autopsy services to one out of every three Minnesota families. In 2015, our regional medical examiner system investigated more than 7,200 deaths and performed nearly 1,200 autopsies. To put those numbers in perspective, in 2000, the first full year we were in our current facility, we investigated only half as many deaths and performed just over 600 autopsies. The facility that we now occupy, a Hennepin County building more than 50 years old, was previously a food service facility retrofitted in 1999 to become the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office. The public health impact of a modern death investigation system cannot be overemphasized. While the murders and high-profile deaths we investigate capture the public imagination and take the lead on the evening news, they're a single-digit percentage of our workload. Far more common are the sudden natural deaths where proper autopsy and diagnosis arm surviving family members with life-saving information and allay the concerns of law enforcement that foul play was present. Equally important is the recognition of accidental deaths, such as the now tragically and increasingly common deaths from heroin and other opiate toxicity we see across the state. And although it does not get talked about as much as perhaps it should, our suicide rate in Minnesota outpaces our homicide rate by many-fold. It is only the proper investigation and classification of such deaths that allows us to address the magnitude of our state's health concerns and target resources and potential remedies accordingly. The role of a medical examiner's office extends far beyond investigating deaths and performing autopsies, however. We provide or contract for a number of laboratory activities such as toxicological and infectious disease testing. We manage, in a nearly paperless environment, an array of records ranging from police reports to hospital charts to death scene photographs. We work with tissue agencies and facilities and families to facilitate organ and tissue donation whenever it's feasible. We sit on the committees that evaluate and care for our most vulnerable citizens, from newborns to the elderly to those with mental or physical impairments. And we are a key component of local, regional, and statewide disaster planning. Think back to the days and weeks after August 1st, 2007, when an eight-lane bridge plummeted into the Mississippi River during rush hour. and imagine your community's response had their medical examiner been unprepared and untrained for such a tragedy. The biggest challenge facing chief medical examiners, and by extension the elected leaders who appoint me, is ensuring that we recruit and retain the qualified physicians required to staff a medical examiner system. To be qualified as a medical examiner in the United States, you have to have a 4-year undergraduate degree, a 4-year medical degree, 3 to 5 years of training in pathology, and an additional year of training in forensic pathology. For most medical examiners, this is 13 or more years of post-high school education. In the United States today, we have approximately 500 medical examiners practicing full-time, but by most estimates, we need more than 1,100 to make sure that every American lives in a city, state, or county where its death investigation system is headed by a qualified individual. The short-term outlook for remedying this problem is not good. By at least one federal estimate, of the more than 18,000 medical students who graduate in America every year, 21 will eventually become full-time medical examiners. I bring this up because any serious discussion of a regional medical examiner system and facility must recognize that a major driver is recruiting and retention. Expecting the most qualified individuals to work in unsupported systems and aging, unaccredited facilities will be disastrous. Sadly, media accounts of medical examiner systems falling apart and the emotional cost this imparts to the families we strive to serve are no longer the province of local media or the problem of other states. As you can see in the handout that I provided to you, no less than the Wall Street Journal just last fall found this nationwide shortage problematic enough to warrant a feature story. Currently in Minnesota, we have 4 medical examiner offices serving the state. Mine, the Ramsey, the Anoka County Medical Examiner offices, and the office run out of the Mayo Clinic. Many of the cases in the Arrowhead, previously handled by the single forensic pathologist there, are now going to Anoka County. Several counties in northwest Minnesota transport to Grand Forks, and I'm aware of several counties in southwest Minnesota that take their bodies to the single forensic pathologist in Sioux Falls. Much of the rest of Minnesota is still covered by a coroner system, meaning that rather than having a medical examiner, a local physician who may be elected or may be appointed decides how deaths get investigated and whether and where an autopsy will be performed. As coroners around the state prepare to retire, county boards will wrestle with the decision whether to maintain their status quo or convert to a medical examiner system by partnering with a nationally accredited medical examiner office such as mine. I submit to you that offices like mine can and should be built and staffed to provide more and more service across the state. In 2013, my office contracted with an outside consulting firm to assess our facility in light of current national standards, federal recommendations, and industry best practices. We are, even by today's standards, at or above capacity. We have approximately 29,000 usable square feet, but should have closer to 34,000. We can store some 36 to 45 bodies in our cooler, but need twice that much capacity. We have 5 working autopsy stations, but we need 9. For long-term planning, we then asked for the state demographer's data for our region through at least 2040, so we could plan and design a facility that would meet the region's needs for the decades to come. The ideal facility poised to serve through 2040 would have 50,000 square feet, be able to store in excess of 100 bodies, and have 13 autopsy stations. If we elect to do nothing, the risks are fairly predictable. As we continue to exceed capacity, we will not be able to recruit and retain the physicians we need to staff the facility. Our accreditation will be put at risk, in part because the facility is too small, and in part because the remaining physicians will exceed national workload guidelines. Loss of accreditation would leave the public and media wondering about the accuracy of reports and the qualifications of the doctors who wrote them, and leave county attorneys wondering how to explain to juries why the medical examiner's office now failed to meet national standards. An inability to expand will leave other Minnesota counties unable to find qualified medical examiner services and meet public expectations and national standards when their coroners retire. And as the only office in the state that teaches medical students, residents, and forensic pathology fellows, my office's teaching ability will dissipate. Ultimately, those who would suffer the most would be the families that we serve, who would now wait months rather than weeks for their loved ones' autopsy findings, or be left to wonder forever because of the autopsies we would simply no longer be able to do. Our current facility in downtown Minneapolis is many decades old, had capacity for the work expected of us, and lacks any feasible options for expansion in its current location. Our current location is a detriment to responding to death scenes in a timely manner, a detriment to customer service, a detriment to retaining the talent we need, and a deterrent to bringing more and more Minnesota counties under the fold of a 21st century, nationally renowned and accredited death investigation system. The proposal you have in front of you is for state bonding for one half the cost of the construction of a new regional medical examiner facility. Such a facility would be designed to serve not only the growing population of the current Dakota Scott Hennepin Regional Partnership, but fully prepared to onboard additional coroner counties for whom a new and geographically convened medical examiner facility would make sense. We would be located in southern Hennepin County, adjacent to one or more major transportation corridors to optimize convenience for families and all of our current and future partners. The remaining cost of the facility and the land and the furnishings and equipment would be borne by Hennepin County. I want to thank the committee for its time, and in particular Representative Albright, for sponsoring this bill.
Thank you, Dr. Baker. Commissioner, do you have anything to add to the presentation?
Yes, I do.
Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'd also like to thank Representative Albright for sponsoring our bill, being the chief author, and to send good wishes to Representative Vogel on his birthday and being here to support us today. One of the vital services provided by government is the investigation of deaths and infectious diseases. This essential service supports both the criminal justice system and the public health system. And as you've heard from Dr. Baker, it requires a significant amount of education, training, and infrastructure to provide the service at the level that our citizens both expect and deserve. Since November of 2001, Scott County has provided medical examiner services through a joint powers agreement in collaboration with other counties, led by Dakota County, at Regina Hospital in Hastings. Beginning in 2013, Scott and Dakota counties entered into a collaborative agreement with Hennepin County for these services. In large part, there were three factors that influenced our decision to make this change. First, it was becoming increasingly more difficult for our smaller collaboration to maintain the staffing needs to adequately provide this service due to the national shortage of qualified medical examiners. As Dr. Baker indicated, last year the Wall Street Journal reported that a 58-year-old man collapsed and died at a convenience store in eastern Montana. His body had to be driven 300 miles to South Dakota for an autopsy because there was no one in Montana to examine the body. This situation highlights the nation's scant supply of forensic pathologists and makes larger regional collaborations in providing this service a must. Second, the facility at Regina was no longer able to meet OSHA standards or requirements with respect to autopsies and infectious disease death investigations. It lacked the needed security to assure integrity for the storage of property and exhibits. It had insufficient space to perform autopsies and physical storage, which required refrigeration. And it had no capacity for expanding future needs based on the growth in death investigations and autopsies. In short, the facility was simply no longer adequate. And while we were aware that within 4 to 7 years, the Hennepin County facility would also be inadequate, it would have been a great waste of tax dollars to build a new facility in 2013 or 2014 to serve Scott and Dakota counties, and then to have Hennepin County need to build a new facility in just a few more years. Again, the right thing to do for our citizens is to provide a larger regional collaboration when there is the need for these types of facilities. And finally, Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office was and is one of the best in the nation. If you're going to create a larger regional facility, it only makes sense to partner with the experts. And Dr. Baker and his staff are exceptional. As we begin to prepare for the construction of a new facility, we ask that the legislature join Hennepin, Dakota, and Scott counties in funding this new medical facility for medical examining to support the projected population growth and the expanding needs within our regional service area and in other counties throughout the state over the next 25 years. As the supply of forensic pathologists gets even tighter and older facilities in other areas begin to fail, the need for this service becomes even greater. This proposal is exactly the type of local request that the legislature should embrace. The planned project will serve a significant public need for a large segment of the state's population in multiple jurisdictions. The facility is phased in its implementation with future expansion capability, and will be built at a location that best supports access needs for the three founding counties and the growing geographic service area. The founding counties are requesting capital dollars for a facility whose operation will then be funded through the counties and not the state. On behalf of Scott County, I would strongly encourage you and ask for your support of this capital project.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Just a couple quick questions. You talked about moving the site from where it's currently at. Do you have a specific location picked out?
I believe that Hennepin County is working on that and is making some good progress. I don't know that they have entered the final stage yet, but have been actively looking for the ideal location. Is there anything you'd like to add?
If I could just dovetail on that answer, Hennepin County is actively negotiating with the seller of the very piece of property that we would like. The letter of intent will probably be done in the next couple of days. The site is ideal in that it's on a major transportation corridor and between two additional major transportation corridors. It's in southern Hennepin County. It is the perfect spot to serve all of our current partners, as well as become a major incentive for coroner-based counties around us as they transition to a modern system to look at us as the obvious choice.
And then my follow-up then to that would be just looking at your old location. It's fairly prime. What's the plan to do with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that answer is, as I used to say when I was in the military, above my pay grade. When we vacate the building, it'll still be Hennepin County property, and what Hennepin County will decide to do with that at this point, I don't know.
Okay.
Perhaps the commissioner can enlighten us on that a little bit, or not?
The current facility is in Hennepin County, and so our association with that facility and with the medical examiner's office is as a partner for services, and really we have no plans for what to do with that facility.
Very good.
We have also toured it with some of our colleagues last fall, and certainly know of the difficulties in the facility and the inability to expand where it is.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, this might be slightly off topic, but it does have to do primarily with the function of the medical examiner's office. My assumption, Dr. Baker, is that in some cases where the cause of death is not known, it's really important to preserve forensic evidence and toxicology work and the like. Why is this not a state-level function where all counties in the state of Minnesota can benefit without having to have joint powers agreements or other agreements, bring all current counties together under one roof and get some more efficiencies and investment, if you will, in plant and capital?
And Dr. Baker.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a fantastic question. Much of the answer to that question is purely historical. Depending on how far back in history you want to go, when we inherited the so-called coroner system from the English hundreds of years ago, the advent of modern medical examiner systems is relatively recent in the late 1800s, starting on the East Coast. It wasn't until 1963 that Hennepin County converted from a coroner system to a medical examiner system. Many of our larger counties in the state have followed suit. Ramsey County, Anoka County, Dakota, Scott, Mayo Clinic now has a regional medical examiner system as well. But the Minnesota statute has always been written on a county-by-county basis. And again, this is historical because county-based coroners are what this country was founded on. What you are describing, a true statewide system, has been done very successfully in other parts of this country. I hold up New Mexico as a prime example. There is one medical examiner's office for the entire state of New Mexico, headquartered at the university in Albuquerque. And they certainly overcome considerable logistical and transportation issues to cover the entire state with that system. So it can certainly be done. I'm not proposing that that's necessarily the model Minnesota would want to go to, but it certainly makes sense for us to regionalize to large offices like mine, like some of the other offices in the state, to provide the best service possible. But historically, it's very much been a county-by-county system.
Follow-up, Representative O'Driscoll, and then we'll have to move on.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's true that, just a follow-up, if you happen to be where I'm from, the central Minnesota area, Stearns and Benton County, it's pretty easy to be able to, that's a relative term, I guess, to transport bodies and evidence and things that your office or others would need. But I'm thinking if you're from Roseau, it becomes a little bit more difficult, and depending upon what's happening, some of that evidence may not be there that you need to be able to determine cause of death, and maybe part of it's too many cops and robber shows over the years, too, that I've watched. But
Mr. Chair, Representative, just to touch on what you just said, generally the concern with transportation of the body isn't that evidence is going to be lost or you're going to miss the cause of death because of perhaps the one-day delay of getting the body to a medical examiner. Really, the biggest hurdle to overcome is simply the cost of the transport. And when does that become a break-even point versus building a facility closer to the area that you're describing? And again, our biggest problem is even if we had the money to build those facilities, we don't have enough forensic pathologists in the country to staff them. It's almost always more cost-effective to bring the bodies to the very rare specialists than to believe we could build enough facilities and train enough specialists to staff all of them. Again, the shortage is just too acute, and so generally overcoming the transportation issues is that's the lowest hanging fruit.
Representative Lilly, and then we'll have to move on.
I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Chair, and your staff for scheduling the tour that we had there that day. It was probably the most memorable tour that I can ever recall. And I don't know why you don't have photos to show us, but
Representative Lilly, I'm fine without the photographs. And yes, the tour was impactful, and thank you for hosting us. You did a great job, but I really don't need to come back. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Thank you very much. We'll move on to 35W Lake Street Transit.
That was unbelievable.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Grub, spelled G-R-U-B as in boy, E. I'm the Hennepin County Highway Engineer. Thank you very much for taking the time to visit with me this afternoon on a presentation regarding work in South Minneapolis along 35W at Lake Street, commonly referred to as the 35W Lake Street Transit Access Project or Transit Station. You should have a brochure at your locations this afternoon that describes or gives you an opportunity to look at how the Transit Access Station fits in the larger vision for 35W South from the 94 Commons down to approximately 42nd Street in South Minneapolis. To provide perspective for you, Hennepin County seeks your support for the financing of some of the local components of the project. The Transit Access Project is a $150 million project. That's a partnership with Hennepin County, the City of Minneapolis, Metro Transit, and MnDOT. It's essentially broken into three parties. Hennepin and Minneapolis are the local partners in this partnership. Each of the partners, MnDOT, Metro Transit, Hennepin, and Minneapolis, is each responsible for nominally $50 million of the $150 million project cost. The $150 million project cost for the Transit Access Project sits in a larger realm for 35W south of the 94 Commons. One of the other two projects themselves are both actually MnDOT projects, and MnDOT has already identified its funding for them. The first one is in your brochure referred to as the Chapter 152 Bridges. It's over on the right-hand column of the right-hand page as you open up the document. And that particular component is in response to legislation passed with the loss of the 35W bridge over the Mississippi River in 2007. Legislation passed and signed into law required that MnDOT and local agencies examine their bridges to see if there were any bridges that could experience catastrophic failure if one of the major members failed. There are two bridges along 35W that fall into that category and must be replaced by legislation by 2018. If you will, July 1st of 2017 is the beginning of your fiscal year for 18, so next year. MnDOT has the funding for replacing those two bridges and the work in the vicinity of those. The first one is the northbound 35W flyover bridge to westbound toward the Lowry Hill Tunnel. The second is the southbound 35W Braid Bridge, which brings the people out of the 94 Commons and brings them into the middle of the freeway system heading southbound with lanes coming out of downtown Minneapolis on the right. Those two bridges must be replaced by law. MnDOT has the funding for them and the related infrastructure, approximately $130 million of funding needed, and they've got it. The second one is the 35W rehabilitation. That's on the left column, on the left side of your brochure as you have it open, and that's the replacement of the pavement from 32nd Street south to 42nd Street along 35W. Approximate cost, $65 million. MnDOT has that funding. MnDOT has circled June of 2017 as the bid letting date for those two projects. And MnDOT has also provided, identified its $50 million share of the transit access project that is shown in the middle, right at the crease of the brochure. That's what I'd like to talk about now, if I could, please. The 35W Transit Access Project, as I said, is the partnership, MnDOT, Metro Transit, and the locals, being Hennepin and Minneapolis. This project is essential for the Orange Line bus rapid transit service that Metro Transit proposes between downtown Minneapolis and Burnsville, an approximate 17-mile stretch of 35W, and then ultimately by 2021 down to Lakeville, connecting people from south of the Minnesota River to downtown Minneapolis and vice versa. The hub, the cornerstone of the Orange Line, is the transit station at Lake Street and 35, in the middle of 35W at Lake Street, where there will be a transit station allowing the buses to enter and exit and pick up fares and let off folks that will be able to go by way of stairway or elevator down to Lake Street below. It's essential that this particular aspect of the project come together for the Orange Line on behalf of Metro Transit, because this is where, in terms of boardings, and availability to jobs and folks in this part of South Minneapolis, availability to jobs south of the Minnesota River is essential. In this brochure, you can see how many homes and how many jobs are affected by or exposed to riders along the Orange Line when completed. Currently, the stop at Lake Street is Spartan at best, where the buses themselves pull over to the side and folks have to stand at a modest shelter southbound and no shelter northbound. If they wish to get down to Lake Street, they have to take a stairway and fight the elements during the winter. Many of you folks had the opportunity to see the transit stop as it exists today and have seen in the brochure what it's proposed in the future. The aspect that we're here to talk about today and the request before you is to realize that while this is an extraordinary project and the time is now right, it does have an effect where the bridges between the 94 Commons and 32nd Street are all taken out and replaced, and the local street system along the edge of the freeway is impacted greatly. Thus, with the local impact and the cost of nominally $50 million to Minneapolis and Hennepin County, we seek your assistance in helping write down that cost. And Hennepin and Minneapolis at this point have identified their $25 million share of the $50 million amount. That's what we seek in terms of support from the legislature today, as you're considering the many requests that will be coming before you. I'd like to thank Representative Hornstein for his support and your support for us in listening to the story I've told you today and understand the importance of this particular aspect before you today. It connects people from South Minneapolis to those south of the Minnesota River and vice versa. It allows people to move who do not necessarily have their own cars to get about the metro area much more easily. It allows us to connect people who use transit on Lake Street in terms of a surface transit system that's in the top three in the entire metro area year after year. This will be a vital connection for the region, the sub-region, and the neighborhoods. It'll provide an impetus for neighborhoods that have been picking themselves up for the last many years to put a piece together to provide with pride for them at that location. Thank you very much for your time, and much appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Grube. Representative Hornstein, welcome to the committee. Do you have anything to add to this presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is my bill. We've had this for several years. I think Mr. Grube gave a very good overview. But this is the busiest transit corridor in the region. And, you know, this all started, you know, these bus rapid transit and transit infrastructure improvements started my freshman year in 2003 when I collaborated with then Representative Mary Liz Holberg from Lakeville. And we had a real interest in making sure that we could address issues of congestion on 35, both road and transit challenges. And you know, we collaborated on getting this what's now known as the Orange Line from downtown Minneapolis to Lakeville. So it serves really, it's one of those projects that really serves both the city and the suburbs. People love this. You know, the park and ride at Lakeville, for example, is always very, oversubscribed sometimes. And so this is just one of these kinds of projects that, you know, brings together suburbs, city, the parties. I think it's a bipartisan initiative. And, you know, when you go to see this facility, many of you might drive down South 35W from Minneapolis. You see crumbling staircases. You see it's not well lit. It's not accessible. This is just, it's embarrassing, this infrastructure. So in order for us to really complete this project, we really do need this bonding. And I think Mr. Grube said that, you know, we have a couple of MnDOT projects, and if we could sequence all of this together, in the long run, we're going to save money. We're going to save a lot of aggravation. If 35W is under construction for years and years and years, then we're going to have problems. So this is cost effective. It's needed. It brings people together, and I hope you'll support it.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Representative Dean has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hornstein, you were close to answering my questions, but I'm really curious, what are the ridership numbers for the Orange Line projected to be moving forward, and has there been any study on what would be actually the added cost and the added time to not do these projects concurrently, and instead we did them sort of one after another, what that would be? Thank you.
Representative
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, I'll just say that the current data we have, this corridor far and away in terms of cars and transit is the busiest in the entire region. But I'll have Mr. Grube talk about the other issues in terms of sequencing the two construction projects.
Thank you. Mr. Grube, please make it brief.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. On the brochure, there is information regarding the number of trips that are anticipated to be attracted by the Orange Line at the Lake Street Station, over 20,000. On the back, you can see that. There is a number of information regarding the demographics of that. In terms of the construction project, when all put together, we're anticipating that will take 4 years of construction, the whole group that's involved in this. If you're going to parse it out, you'd be somewhere in the range of 5 to 8 years. It'd be very difficult to get along that corridor if not coordinated.
Thank you, Mr. Grube. Representative Osmond has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I always thought I understood this project. We always went up. And so somehow I thought that's where the riders were going to get the bus. But all of this seems to say, is the whole highway going under instead? Because it doesn't look like all the pictures show something different.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the riders will go up from Lake Street to the station on 35W. You can see many of the pictures are showing at grade of Lake Street how it opens up what is right now a dark box. But the folks will go up from Lake Street up to 35W.
Thank you. Representative Rembeck has the final question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is kind of on the same vein, Representative Hausman's. So if you have, you're building new exit ramp and entrance ramp, why wouldn't the buses just go down, exit, and then enter again, and have your transit station below?
Mr. Grubb.
Thank you very much for that question, Mr. Chair and members. In this particular case, the speed with which people and light and disembark from the bus is the critical factor for bus rapid transit. The idea is that the bus will be stopped for approximately 30 to 40 seconds and then moving along. And it would be an unstopped condition where once you leave the freeway, you're at the mercy of the signals along the local ramp system. This one will allow embark and disembark in a matter of 30 to 40 seconds, and they're out the door again.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Grubb. Thank you for your presentation. I'm sorry to rush you, but we're running a little behind time.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Thanks for being with us today. Next up, we have the Cedar Cultural Center. Oh, I'm sorry. I skipped over one. Art Space is next. My mistake. Art Space, you're up. And on deck is the Cedar Cultural Center. Sorry about that. And I'm going to do what I hate to do, and that is rush the final presenters, but we have gotten a little behind. So
no, that's fine.
Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We will be brief. My name is Stacy Mickelson. I represent ArtSpace Project based in Minneapolis.
I'm Lynn Von Eschen, and I'm the Executive Director for the Cole Center.
We do not anticipate this taking too much time because I think most of you have actually been to the site once or twice with us. So I want to introduce to you ArtSpace Projects. We are a Minneapolis-based 501c3 nonprofit real estate development organization. We have 39 projects across the United States. It's about $600 million worth of property that we command, own, operate, and manage. The Cole Center will be a part of that. What's interesting or what's important about that number that I just shared with you, that nearly $750,000 of real estate that we own, operate, and manage, most of that is financed or funded with 80% of it, in fact, is financed and funded through federal, state, or local funding dedicated to housing, to economic development, or community revitalization. We have proven time and time again in the 35 years that we've been in business that we are good stewards of public resource, and we have never defaulted on any of those agreements that we have with state or federal agencies. And so I think that's an important piece for you to recognize. That information about ArtSpace is on the back side of the flyer that we have handed out to you if you want to reference that piece and see our work across the United States.
In the flyer that Stacy just mentioned, if you look at the front page, you'll learn a little bit more about the Cole Center. The Cole Center has opened in 2011, and we have operated in the black since the beginning of the center. And we are in the middle of our fifth season, of which we present over 20 local dance companies on our season on a yearly basis, of which many performances sell out. We also are the home to over 20 nonprofit organizations with office space within our eight-story building. And then also we produce and on a yearly basis a statewide education program where we offer free residencies into the classroom. So we connect artists with students either in the classroom or throughout the state of Minnesota through our distance learning technology. And this year we're proud to say that we will have over 500 residency programs this year.
The total request for this legislative session is $7 million in saved bonds to help us achieve our $10 million budget for renovation, rehabilitation, and asset preservation. Lynn has some interesting news that you also have a flyer that was submitted with our proposal, an article from the Star Tribune.
So at the end of 2015 in December, we were the recipient of a $3 million gift from the Caroline Ant Plants Giving Program, of which is towards this project. And also in 2015, the McKnight Foundation moved the fellowship program for dancers and choreographers to the Cole Center, which is a $1.2 million program. And in the 5 years that we've been building our programming and our organization, we continue to raise the annual funds that are needed to keep the operation in the black. Many major gifts coming from corporate and foundations within the Twin Cities and several individuals.
Of the $10 million need in the request, if you open your flyer to the middle portion and look on the left-hand side, you'll see the details about brickwork and the stonework and the cleaning of the building. And then on the bottom left-hand side, you'll see a conversation about the cupolas and the frieze work, some of the more decorative pieces to the building. While they appear maybe cosmetic, they are essential to the sustainability and the safety that is around the building. There's been no attention paid to this building since 1977 when we took it over. It was the last any kind of renovation was made. Mostly we've been patching and tuck pointing here and there when it mattered, but those are some of the things that we'll be working on and addressing.
As Stacy said, the building has not had attention since the 70s. In fact, the elevators within the building are original, and they're about 125 years old. We have two elevators that take us from the first floor up to the eighth floor, of which the mechanical systems on those elevators do break quite often. And they are so old that you can't just go and get a new part and replace it. They have to be fabricated. So there are times when an elevator will go out of commission and may be down for days, if not weeks, of which this fall we were the home to VSA had a statewide conference on accessibility within the arts, and our elevators went out. So you could imagine having a conference in your building about accessibility, and we only had, both were down for a day, but we got one working at least for part of the conference. So this is a significant need, and it impacts the 20 nonprofit organizations in our building and the theater that's on the eighth floor when audiences come, and they may have to walk up eight flights to see the production. In addition to that, the roof has over 40-some years old. It's been patched and patched and patches on top of patches, and it continues to leak, and sometimes the theater on the eighth floor is not usable because of the leaking that's happening, and there are other spaces, leasable spaces within the building that have been damaged, and so those cannot be leased until significant repair has been made. So between the elevators and the roof, those are two significant areas of need.
And to leave you with a very dramatic example, this is a brick from the eighth floor, one of several that we have that have fallen from the roof line. And it is because of ice damming and the poor roof that we have in the gutter system that is just unusable anymore. And so these bricks, happily, they're on the backside of the building, and so they've only taken out dumpsters and a few car hoods. But it could take out some people. And that is something that we have, you can see that there's a grave concern to us and a huge liability that these elements are causing problems for us, and so we need help.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, guys. Is there any, just quick question, is there any non-state funds?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, there's a $3 million, and then smaller funds that have come in that we are continually working towards.
That sounds good. Well, seeing no other questions, thank you very much for your presentation, and we'll get the Cedar Cultural Center up if we're ready to roll. Representative Khan.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. The mission of the Cedar Cultural Center is to promote intercultural appreciation and understanding through the presentation of global music and dance to one of the most diverse parts of the city of Minneapolis. And rather than try and present this, I'd like to present Adrian Dorn, the executive director, and Abdurizak Behi, a board member, to give you the information that's also in your flyer.
Thank you, Representative Khan. If you would also introduce yourself for the record. And
thank you, Chairman and Representative. Good afternoon. My name is Adrian Dorn, and I am the Executive Director of the Cedar Cultural Center, and we also have several board members here today sitting in the front row. We are a nonprofit music venue, now in our 27th season, located in the Cedar Riverside neighborhood of Minneapolis. As Representative Kahn just said, our mission is to promote intercultural appreciation through music. We do this by presenting 200 live, all-ages music concerts per year, and that features musicians from all over the world who perform in all genres, and we also present programs that include artist-led workshops, discussions, residencies, classroom visits, and other activities. Some of you were able to experience music on our stage during the bonding tour. I'm here today to ask your support for HF 2308, which would provide $3 million for the Cedar to renovate our facility as part of a $7 million capital campaign, which would be the first in the organization's history. We appreciate Hennepin County's partnership in this effort. At the Cedar, we have enjoyed significant support for our programs. We're currently serving the largest and most diverse audience in our history, but our facilities are untenable. At this juncture, in order to continue our work, it is imperative that deferred facility maintenance be addressed. Our building was built in 1949 as a 250-seat movie theater, and we are now serving 65,000 people per year in this facility. We sometimes have 700 people in the room at a time. So for a building that was built to accommodate 250, you can imagine that wear and tear builds over the years. We're located in the middle of a low-income community where a lot of residents have physical disabilities, but we're not able to adequately serve or work with them because our building is not fully ADA accessible. It's a huge limitation to our impact and to our ability to fulfill our mission. So while there are a lot of ways to improve our facility to make it sustainable, the very top priority of this campaign is making our venue fully accessible. Just to talk a little bit about the impact that our programming has had, I believe that art and music specifically improves lives, and over the past decade, I've witnessed the positive impact of the Cedar's work specifically. I have seen our music programs improve health by bringing elders out of isolation, placate prejudice and misunderstanding by bringing groups of people from different cultures and religions together, and help youth find an identity by connecting to and feeling proud of their culture. For 27 seasons, we have played a key role in the region by bringing legendary and innovative national and international touring musicians to Minnesota that would never otherwise come here. And audience members do travel from all over the state to see these artists. But we also have an impact beyond the Twin Cities. In 2014, we launched our first touring program called Minnesota Express, which united five local musicians of diverse styles to perform a 10-day tour in seven communities throughout greater Minnesota. And our Mid-Nemo program, Mid-Nemo is Somali for Unity. It engages acclaimed and legendary Somali artists from around the world in multi-week residencies that include concerts, workshops, discussions, and other activities in a variety of venues around the Twin Cities for Somali and non-Somali audiences. This program has had a huge impact, but perhaps the most repeated piece of feedback we have gotten is that we really have to bring this to other places in Minnesota. And so in response to that, and that's because, of course, there are a lot of communities and other places in Minnesota that have rapidly growing Somali populations. So in response to that, in August of 2015, we brought Mid-Nemo to Mankato with a live performance and a workshop featuring Somali artists. And we are currently planning a full residency with some Somali artists from Amsterdam, which will take place in St. Cloud in partnership with St. Cloud State University and Paramount Theater. And that will take place in November of this year. We have received additional funding to expand and sustain Mid-Nemo from a number of local and national foundations, including the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Foundation of Minnesota, in recognition of the program's role in promoting public health, which I think is notable since we are an arts organization receiving funding to improve health. And that's because we believe, as does the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Foundation, that this program is fostering important social connections and improving social and mental health. So as you can see, our organization and the programming is soaring. Community support for our work and our ability to raise private dollars is demonstrated by the successful completion of phase one of this campaign. We raised $700,000 in support to transform our fenced-in outdoor property into an open community plaza that is now a hub of activity. So we are confident that we will be able to raise the additional $4 million from foundations and private contributions to match $3 million bonding request. Community support is also apparent through the 350 people who volunteer at our organization every year and the 1,000 people who donate every year. We have 17 members on the board of directors, and that includes a mix of corporate executives, skilled professionals, community members, as well as artists. So we are, at the CEDAR, we are playing a very important role in bringing people together and building understanding among our state's diversifying population. Our work is improving quality of life in Cedar Riverside, in the metro area, and throughout the state. And even more opportunities lie ahead. Our history of success has only scratched the surface in realizing the power of music to improve communities, but we need a sound facility. So I strongly encourage you to support the CEDAR's bonding request to help in this important renovation.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Chair, members, my name is Abdul Rizak Bihi. My first name is spelled A, B as in Brook, D as in David, I, R, I, Z, A, K. My last name is Easy, B, I, H, I. I'm a Somali community activist and I'm a director of Somali Education and Social Advocate Center in Minneapolis, in Cedar Riverside. I'm also a proud board member of this great institution, as well as a long time, 16 years resident and a father in that neighborhood. I can't speak enough about this work because my primary work, which is absolutely self-work, is about engaging young people, positive programming and in arts away from radicalization, since it happened to my family. Cedar Cultural Center opened up music 8 years ago. Radicalists in my community would tell the community, music is forbidden, haram, and young people would go without a culture. We took a brief step to resuscitate and bring it back. That centuries all of music and culture, where right now we have to turn people away because of the capacity. Everyone now turned into a singer and an artist because of this venue. And that helped me reduce my work of breaking the cycle of isolation in our young population, Cedar Riverside. Right now, yesterday I was in St. Cloud University with the Somali Student Association, talking to them about Minimo and in November. It's amazing how people want and how timely it is that both neighbors are working together to host this amazing thing. I think it touched people more than anything else I did, whether it's creating jobs and trainings with Alina or training people at Summer Academy. I think this was the fastest route to fend off bad things from our young population, and I really do appreciate it, your understanding and support of bonding this building. It's too small. Our elders want to use it. Our young population, which is at 20 years average, we're about 10,000 members in that small space. So this is the facility that makes a difference in our lives, one of the best. I thank you.
Thank you. Representative, would you like to wrap this up for us? Or?
Well, I think they did a terrific job. I don't think I have anything to add except that this is very important to the diverse communities in the city of Minneapolis.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Kahn. Thank you, presenters, for your presentation today. We'll move on. Next up, we have the St. Paul Port Authority. Please introduce yourself. We have handouts coming, but please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, good afternoon. My name is Lori Lauder, and I am the Senior Vice President of Business and Intergovernmental Affairs at the St. Paul Port Authority.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'll try to go quickly, and my colleagues will too. First of all, I wanted to mention that what is on the Port Authority's legislative agenda is the Minnesota Ports Development Association request for $10 million of capital investment funds for the four harbors. And, Mr. Chair, I should mention the Port Authority has a mission that involves three things: to create quality job opportunities, to assist with business expansion, and to advance sustainable development. And as part of that, I am speaking for my Port Authority here for a minute as well as the Minnesota Ports Development Association, which is a 22-year-old association consisting of the water-based ports in Minnesota, Duluth, Winona, Red Wing, and St. Paul. Mr. Chair, thank you for your time, and I also particularly wanted to thank you and your colleagues for prior support. Infrastructure needs in all four of our harbors are enormous, as you can see. And so we do request $10 million from this session's allocation to continue our improvement and reconstruction of these infrastructure projects or infrastructure portions of the harbor. In closing, Mr. Chair, on this part, we need to continue to allow our businesses to move products efficiently through both the Great Lakes and also the Upper Mississippi Waterway System. Secondly, we need to continue a terrific activity in terms of exporting. Not only do we import products like road salt and so forth, but there's a lot of exporting from our businesses to worldwide markets. And lastly, we need to serve our business customers with this infrastructure as they need and, quite frankly, as they expect. Mr. Chair, that's the first part of my presentation. I'd be happy to take questions, or I can go to the second and last part. Your pleasure.
Go right ahead, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, the second part is not part of the Port Authority's legislative agenda, but it does propose to use a function that the Port Authority is able to do. I wanted to introduce colleagues that hope to speak here today, so I'll be very quick. First of all, to my right is Kristen Macholm. She is the Executive Director of the Minnesota Museum of American Art. Teresa Stearns is here also, who is her consultant. She is the owner and CEO of Stearns Associates. Terry Mattson is here as well, President and CEO of Visit St. Paul. And Bill Huppenbecker, Senior Director of Planning and Public Affairs for the River Center and the Xcel Energy Center. Mr. Chair, before I turn the remainder over of this presentation to my colleagues, I wanted to mention the Port Authority's role. Since state GO bonds are not allowed to go to 501c3 corporations, sometimes we're asked to be their local sponsor. You may recall a few years ago the University Enterprise Labs asked us to do that as well. That was not funded, and that's not in front of us today. The other thing is occasionally other governmental units will approach the Port Authority and ask us to assist by using our expertise. And so this is true for the Roy Wilkins and the associated parking ramp, which Terry will speak to. So we do appreciate and are pleased to lend our services for economic development projects, obviously ones that improve the economy and that drive job creation. So we're a local sponsor if the projects are approved. And we will provide, if funded, fiscal agent services, and also to work on all the details with MMB to make sure that all of the requirements of the use of GO bonds through MMB's activities are something that we are making sure these projects are in compliance with. With that, Mr. Chair, I turn it over to my colleagues. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kristen Macholm. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Museum of American Art here in St. Paul, and I'm here to talk about the new Minnesota Museum of American Art and its request for a capital investment in the amount of $8.5 million for the establishment of the museum in a permanent home in the Pioneer Endicott Building in St. Paul. I, first of all, wanted to thank the committee for listening to us today, and also for many of you who came to do the tour of the building a few months ago. Several of you were there, and I do notice that you have a handout that with some information, so that should be there. I also notice it's not in color, so if I may ask my colleague here, the luck of the Irish, Teresa Stearns, to pass out some renderings of our new building. You can see them in color and see what that new building is going to look like. The Port Authority will be the public owner of a state bond qualified lease and will sublease the space to the museum to run programs for the benefit of the public. The MMAA, for short, is St. Paul's only art museum, and it's been without a permanent home for too long. Our mission is to inspire people to discover themselves and their communities through American art. However, we dig deeper into that, and we're the only museum that takes as its focus the artists and the art of Minnesota, past, present, and future. We do this through art exhibitions, through art classes, and through art education programs. And we engage people in diverse communities, and we make art accessible to all people. We propose to expand from our current 3,000 square foot gallery in the Pioneer Endicott building in downtown St. Paul to a larger footprint of 40,000 square feet in that same building, which will be will create a new, vibrant, and embedded art museum to experience innovative, multifaceted programs in new public spaces, an education wing with classrooms and a maker space directly on the Skyway and the light rail line. We will also finally have a place to showcase our collection of over 4,000 works of American art that we've been collecting since the 1940s and that have been in storage for far too long. This is work by famed Minnesota artists like Paul Manship and George Morrison, and incredible collections of contemporary art that really showcase the amazing talent we have in the state of Minnesota. There are several very compelling details about the project, but which I want to show you. I hope will show you why now is the time to get this museum established in a permanent and sustainable way. First of all, this museum is shovel ready. We have completed pre-design and our construction documents, and we are ready to build this museum right away with state support. Secondly, we've raised our matching funds. The museum trustees and myself have raised $8 million so far for our match. That includes $1 million in support from the city of St. Paul. The rest of it is a combination of both public, national, as well as private funds for the other $7 million. We're building this museum in an iconic structure in St. Paul. Many of you who came through note that the Pioneer Endicott is one of the great 19th century buildings in St. Paul that has been underutilized for many of the last decades. It's now a housing and residential place. There's apartments on all the upper floors, but we are proposing to take over an acre of space, 40,000 square feet, on the first floor of this building for a public use. We will intersect with the great architecture of Cass Gilbert, who was the architect of your Capitol building, the architect of many other buildings across the country, but is the architect that designed the Endicott in 1890. This is a perfect marriage of bringing a museum for the public back into a great piece of architecture in St. Paul that has not been utilized to its capacity in a very long time. And I wanted to thank you all again for taking the tour and seeing, because I think you need to see how the museums can intersect in a really dynamic way with the architecture. I wanted to just say one word about economic impact. As many of you know, in the Creative Minnesota study of last year, we know that the arts are an enormous boost to economic in the economics in Minnesota. $1.2 billion in total economic impact annually in this state. The reestablishment of this museum is part of this continuing growth and vitality that are so critical to our state's economic and social well-being. This museum will serve 80,000 people when it's up and running in its full form, and 80,000 people annually, and it'll add 14 permanent jobs and 138 construction period jobs. And if I can just say, one of my former speakers earlier wished you all a happy St. Patrick's Day. I'm going to wish you a happy Arts Advocacy Day, because I know you've all been maybe bombarded by all sorts of folks who talk about the importance of the arts in this community. So we really want to say that this is all part of expanding the economic vitality through the arts, and we thank you for your support for the arts throughout the state of Minnesota. Finally, I want to say that a strong Minnesota Museum of American Art is also about a strong museum bringing programs into your communities throughout the state where you live and serve. So our museum has taken exhibitions in the last 5 years to places across the state, such as Lanesboro and Duluth and Moorhead and Morris. And we are now already talking with folks in St. Cloud and Winona to bring exhibitions of work from our collection, as well as other Minnesota artists into those parts, into the state. So we're much more than a place in St. Paul. We are here for the state of Minnesota. With state money, we can start building this museum in August. We've got the shovels ready. We're ready to build in August. 10 months of construction, this great new museum could be open in the fall of 2017. We hope you will help us finally allow this museum to claim its position again as one of the leading art museums in Minnesota and grant our request for bonding in this year's session. So I would like to thank I'd like to thank the committee. I'd like to thank all of you. I want to thank Representative Hausman for sponsoring the bill, and all of you for listening to me today. Mr. Chairman, if you have any, I can entertain any questions if you have them.
Thank you, Ms. Macklem. I don't know how you did that without taking a breath, but you did very well. We are running short of time.
I know you're in a hurry, so excuse me.
And you're right. Well, thank you for your presentation. I don't see any questions. We have one more presentation yet today, so I will excuse you and ask the, the parking ramp in Roy Wilkins Auditorium folks to come forward. I apologize to my fellow members and to the audience for running over time, and I apologize to you for having to rush you through your presentation. I would remind everyone that Representative Mahoney brought treats, and thank you for that, Representative Mahoney, and those who have not indulged yet will indulge on their way out.
And, Mr. Chair, I certainly hope you announce where they came from, Sugar Rush Bakery on University Avenue, the best donuts around.
Double Dick.
Mr. Chair, I know you're running late, so I'll be very, very brief. I'll just say this is an important issue for City of St. Paul. I certainly hope the committee can give it as much attention as possible. This deals with the River Center and the parking lot. So with that, I'll turn it over to the testifiers.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Terry Matson. I'm the president and CEO of Visit St. Paul and the River Center Authority. Thank you for the opportunity to present today. We have two topics included in the same proposal. One is the River Center parking ramp, the other the Roy Wilkins Center. I want to thank the St. Paul Port Authority for shepherding us to the legislature, and also Representative Mahoney for authoring and helping us celebrate St. Patrick's Day. I should point out that the original request to the legislature was for the Roy Wilkins only, but was amended to include the parking ramp based on very real and urgent results of a just completed ramp engineering study. This is important to the River Center facility, St. Paul, as well as everyone in the capital city. I know many of you had a chance to tour our infrastructure needs this past fall. Why does the River Center parking ramp need to be reconstructed? It's antiquated. The urgency of the study points out that, well, if I were here 1 year ago, I would probably say that that parking ramp had yet 10 years left in its lifespan. The engineering study revealed that at best that ramp maybe has 5 years of useful life as a safe and appropriate facility, maybe as little as three. So you can see that our backs are to the wall when we talk about how we're going to fund this ramp, how we're going to design it, how we're going to build it and maintain our operations. And I should point out, too, that to keep the ramp safe and open in the next 3 to 5 years, we'll be investing approximately $750,000 to $1 million a year. So it is an interesting situation at best. Why do we need a new Roy Wilkins Auditorium? Kind of the same situation. It's a very antiquated infrastructure. The Roy has been an important economic, educational, and cultural facility for St. Paul and all of Minnesota, but it's outdated and frankly underused. Each year we're missing out on millions of dollars of direct revenues and tax revenues to local authorities and also the state of Minnesota. This existing facility is inaccessible. It's not ADA accessible or compliant. It doesn't have enough storage space or usable restrooms, and its concourse, concession space, and dressing rooms are very outdated and substandard. This request in aggregate is for $1.9 million in design funds in 2016. What benefits will the new ramp offer? And this is all outlined in your proposal. Probably more importantly to say that if we don't have a new parking ramp as a convention center and entertainment facility, we're basically dead in the water. Parking ramps aren't necessarily glamorous, but you need to have a good working and safe parking ramp in order to conduct business. The number of spaces and the revenue that is generated is also important to the River Center facility. I can tell you that convention centers nowhere in America or throughout the world make money. St. Paul is a little bit different, the River Center, than other convention centers such as Minneapolis or Duluth, for example, in that we don't receive city subsidies. The $2 million and plus of revenue that comes from parking operations is what prevents us from running a $2 million plus deficit each year. So we depend on those revenues for operating. What benefits will a new center offer? Again, tens of millions of dollars of new business. It will allow us to thrive as a super block with the River Center and the Xcel Energy Center. The new center will be flexible design meeting space. Picture something transformer-like where we can, in a high-tech way, host a number of different events, activities, galas, with the ability to change and meet the needs of the marketplace. We also need things like competitive and state-of-the-art video and sound systems and teleconferences capabilities. With the new Roy Wilkins Center, we'll be able to attract additional conventions, meetings, and other forms of business. I think it's also important to point out that the center will focus on attracting medium-sized shows to complement the large conventions that Minneapolis does, and also the regional and specialized shows of greater Minnesota with convention facilities in St. Cloud, Duluth, Rochester, and so on. So we included visuals in your proposals. I want to go through this very quickly. Folks, I'll conclude by mentioning again the urgency. There's no drama here, just the facts. We need a new parking ramp, our backs to the wall. I'm here hat in hand. This isn't just the city of St. Paul we're talking about. We're not just a city with a capital. We are the capital city. Please give this your utmost consideration. Mr. Huppenbecker and I are here to happily answer any questions that you may have. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I do not see any questions from members. Representative Mahoney, do you have any closing remarks?
I'm just shocked there's donuts left. This is a great proposal. I hope you folks can help out.
And hats off to the what bakery was it?
Sugar Rush.
Sugar Rush Bakery. Members, with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.